This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, our guest is Sister Agnes Cunningham, and we're talking about her life as a theologian. Welcome, Sister Agnes.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve.
Now, am I addressing you correctly? Because after all, you have a PhD, a doctor of theology, you've been a professor. What's the higher title? What's the most appropriate title for someone in your shoes?
Well, I'm most comfortable with Sister Agnes.
But professor?
But I would, well, I have an ecclesiastical doctorate, and that is in the line of the degrees that run parallel to what we're accustomed to in the United States. So it isn't a PhD, it's an STD.
So that would be a doctorate in sacred,
sacred theology. Correct.
Okay.
And I would ordinarily be called doctor.
And that is a, the STD degree is, it may be older than a PhD.
Oh, it could be. I don't know that I've ever looked into that question. But, you know, I'm the kind of person, when someone asks me a question and I don't know the answer, I'll go home and I'll look it up. And so the next time.
And that's probably what made you a successful academic as well, isn't it? That curiosity?
I think so. I really do. Just last week, I'd been away. I've been away on a mini sabbatical, and I had been asked to give a lecture spontaneously on the Fathers of the Church to a group that was not familiar with it. Well, a few days afterwards, in the ecclesiastical readings for the morning, for morning prayer, there was a reference to St. Mary Magdalene as the prostitute and sinner. And someone who'd heard my talk came by and said, "And who was the Father of the Church who did that to her?" And I didn't know. After it was at breakfast. After breakfast, I went upstairs and found out. So I'm haunted. I'm driven to know the answer to a question, because it's all a search for truth in the end, which is a search for God, in, as I perceive it, you know.
Now, since you raised that question but didn't give us the answer, listeners may want to know.
Well, it was Tertullian in the early 2nd century who referred to it, but then Origen, the first biblical scholar in Christianity, put that aside and saw her as the apostle to the apostles, but it was Gregory the great Benedictine monk who became a pope and did wonderful things pastorally, who said, "Here was the sinner. Mary Magdalene was the sinner." And the person who asked me was a Benedictine, and I didn't have a chance to go back and say it was your own Gregory who did it to her.
Now, for our non-Catholic listeners, and as you know, I'm a Protestant Christian myself, and so I'm ignorant about many of these things. Let's talk a little bit about your career. How unusual was it for a woman to get that STD degree, to be a professional theologian, to then teach in colleges and seminaries alongside males when you got that degree? How unusual was it?
Well, the school I attended was the Catholic University in Lyon, France. I was the first woman. They were the first theological institute to open their programs to women. I was the first woman to enter the program. I was the first woman to receive both the licentiate in sacred theology, which was a requirement even to begin the studies for the doctorate, and the first woman to receive the doctorate in sacred theology from that school. Now, there might have been others, perhaps in Germany, there might have been women in sacred theology. I'm not sure about that. But a French theologian, René Laurentin, who is now deceased and is known for many of his writings and works, publications, he once was in the United States and spent a weekend at our little convent in Batavia, Illinois, because he wanted to make a connection with me. He told me that I was the first woman in the Catholic world with a doctorate of that nature, and the first woman in the Catholic world to teach theology at a major seminary. I have never verified that. I wasn't curious enough to go after that question, but he seemed to know that. And it was a different experience, a very different experience studying, first of all, the French priests and seminarians who were in the program in Lyon. They didn't know exactly what to do with me. The first thing they did was after class in the middle of a morning one day, they said, "We want to show you something." So they took me across the street from the university to a little pub and said, "This is the time for a 10 o'clock glass of white wine." I don't know if they were just putting me on or not. But I was a kind of anomaly, you know.
Now, tell me what year, what decade would that have been when you first began your study and got your licentiate, you said?
Licentiate in sacred theology. Yes. We had a very foresighted provincial superior who asked me to study theology at Marquette University in 1957. Marquette and Notre Dame had both opened their programs in theology to lay people, and that would have included the sisters.
Sure.
So I was on my way to a doctorate in English at St. Louis University, and that's where my heart was. Huh. And she said, "If you do this, I'll let you go and finish the doctorate in English." Uh-huh. Well, this lasted 5 years because it was a summer program. And she said, "You make the choice. I'll be here for 48 hours and you can tell me." So I went to the chapel, Steve, and I knew three things. I knew that I had not entered religious life to get a doctorate in English. I knew that if the provincial thought there ought to be people with an M.A. in English, which, in theology, which it would have been, why would I say no? Uh-huh. And I knew that if I said yes, I'd never get the doctorate in English. So I said yes. And that was at Marquette, and that was in 57. I finished the program in 62. By that time, I was teaching with the sisters who had Mundelein College in Chicago, a college for women. And there were two of their sisters in that same Masters of Arts in Theology program. And they invited me to teach with them. And I taught with them for 3 years. In 1963, by then we had another farsighted provincial who said that now that I had the master's degree in theology, she'd like me to do a doctorate. And I said, "I'm going to be like a patchwork quilt." I said, "I have a degree in liturgical music. I said, I have a degree, a bachelor's degree in English. I have a master's in theology." I said, "Why don't you take one person and have her start at the beginning and go through?" And that dear, wonderful lady, she said, "You silly girl, this is not for you. It's for the church. The church is going to need women prepared in theology in the future. I want you to do this."
So even though no woman had ever done it before, this provincial superior of yours suggested it to you strongly, and you were willing to do it.
I was willing to do it. And that year there was a doctorate in theology, a PhD program that was to start that next fall at Marquette University. And I'd been invited to join that, and I said, I wouldn't even ask. I said, "I don't need a doctorate in theology. We just had grade schools and a couple of high schools. And I was already teaching with these other sisters at Mundelein College." And so I said no. And so I asked her. I said, "Well, is it all right if I investigate the program at Marquette?" "No, no, no," she said. "You've had enough American theology." Uh-huh. She said, "The church is universal. I want you to have a global, universal understanding of what the church is." So I said, "Well," she said, "you can go anywhere you want in Europe. I'd like you to go to France because we were founded in France, our congregation." But she said, "You don't have to." So I wrote to a number of faculties, institutes in theology. There's one story that it's one of the regrets in my life. I have very few regrets. One of the places I wrote was the Catholic Institute in Paris. I had a letter in return from the secretary of the department who said that he and the dean had decided that sisters should be at home in their convents, and it would certainly be unheard of for a woman to be admitted to their theology program. I was so angry, Steve, I tore the letter up. Today it would be a document.
Classic, yes.
It would be. Uh-huh. I was so angry. Uh-huh. Lyon, they wrote and said...
Isn't there the possibility of confession in the Catholic Church?
Oh, yes.
You are past that now.
I've taken care of that. Okay. That's been taken care of. But Lyon wrote and said... send your credentials and the credits, all your documentation, and you'll be the first one in the program. And we are the first Catholic faculty in France to admit women. We have not yet had a woman.
Huh. And did you ever find out why Lyon was more accepting, more open than Paris?
Ah, Lyon. Wonderful Lyon. Where in the year 177 A.D., there was one of the first terrible persecutions of Christians in Gaul, and where a young priest, presbyter, named Irenaeus was saved because he'd been sent on a mission to Rome, came back, and because the bishop had been martyred, he was named bishop, and laid the foundations of Catholic Christian, really, theology. Anybody after Irenaeus developed what he had laid the groundwork for. First one to read, as far as I've been able to find out, the first one to read the Old Testament Christologically. The first one really to attack Gnosticism head on. The first one to have insights into some of the wonderful texts in Paul about the role of Christ as head of a church that was to be brought to the Father. So that was the tradition in Lyon. And their major foci in the theological school, there were two, Scripture and Patristics. The fathers of the church.
The earliest Christian thinkers.
The earliest Christian thinkers.
Systematic thinkers.
Early Christian writers are often called.
Yes. We're talking on Keeping the Faith today with Sister Agnes Cunningham, who has admitted to us she's a very curious person, although she's never really bothered to find out if she's really the very first woman to get an STD, a doctorate in theology in the Catholic Church, but she's been told by others she has.
That's correct.
We're glad to have you on the program. Let me give the phone numbers for listeners who'd like to make a call and ask a question. We're talking about her life as a theologian. I feel very, very privileged to be in the studio with her here in Urbana. But listeners can have the privilege of asking a question or making a comment as well. Listeners in Champaign, Urbana area, if it's a local call, 333-9455. Of course, if it's long distance, if you're listening elsewhere, even on the internet, you may call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. So if it's a long-distance call, 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of the station, or in Champaign, Urbana, 333-9455. Sister Agnes, did you grow up in a Catholic home?
Oh, I did, Steve. My father was from Galway, Ireland. My mother was a very proud English Catholic woman from a place near, the district of Liverpool. Lancashire is what I, the county,
Lancashire
County, a small town named Wigan. And they were good Catholics. My father had not been exposed to some of the things my mother had. And she was always more or less on the edge of things. My father would have been more what people today might call traditional, although I don't like labels. But he was the kind of person who wanted to go to to Mass, attend Mass every day, and did, but would not receive Holy Communion unless he'd been to confession before, until the priest one day told him, Michael, you're like an old woman, you know, stop this. I don't want to see you again for a week or something. Now, my mother would not have been like that. So it was a wonderful blend of strong spiritual devotion on the side of my mother and good, insightful thinking on the part of my father, the devotion, my mother, the thinking.
Interesting.
She was the one who often, once I had started the doctoral program in theology, she was the one who often gave me the hardest questions because they'd been in her mind and she'd been looking for somebody to answer them.
Now, did either of your parents have a college education?
My father, Steve, finished seventh grade in a little country school in Ireland and was kept on for a year or two after to help the teacher teach because he was very gifted. Yeah. My mother finished Teachers Training College in English, taught, was a Red Cross nurse in the First World War, studied millinery, tailoring, was always inventing and searching things, and probably as curious as I ever was. I must have gotten it from her. You know, if I could just say one little story. When I'd come home from school as a child in grade school, the first question my mother would ask me was, what did you learn today? And I would tell her. And I would say, Sister said, because I was in a Catholic school. And when I finished saying what Sister said, my mother would say, well, didn't Sister tell you about this and that? And Sister wouldn't have. And I remember saying one time, why wouldn't Sister have told me those things? And my mother said, well, maybe she's very young in teaching, or maybe she hasn't had a chance to do a lot of reading. It's very important to read, she'd say to me. So I was always asking questions. Now, that has had disadvantages in my life, because sometimes when I've been in a group, even with some of our sisters, and someone will say something or give an answer to something, I will always come up with this, well, maybe it was this, another idea.
Other thoughts.
And I think that has bothered people, you know, irritated them sometimes. But that's the way I am, and it's my mother's fault. I have her head genes.
We have a caller who is going to join the conversation. Happy to include the person on line number one. Yes, you're talking with Sister Agnes Cunningham.
Yes, Sister Agnes. Good afternoon. I'd like to know what you think about the role of the women in the church, like if you think that in your lifetime you might see women priests, and whether the church is ever going to allow birth control in especially countries where it's pretty disastrous when people have a lot of children they can't support.
Thank you. You have a number of questions there. You have several questions. The first question about the role of women in the church, an extremely interesting question. And I have to say that for a number of years, I did research on that question just because I wondered about it myself. In the very early church, the period that a person who knows the fathers of the church wondered about the mothers of the church, there were more roles, more official roles for women than there are today, liturgically and in terms of charity. In what we call Orthodox Christianity, not in terms of the Orthodox churches as we know them today, but Catholic Christianity, if you want to use the term universal Christianity, the earliest Christianity, there is never any evidence of a woman having been ordained a priest, except in splinter groups that were often labeled heretical. Several years ago, there was a book that was published by a woman who claimed to have found a document in which a pope did refer to women priests. Well, you know, with that curious mind of mine, I went looking for the document, which I had not seen previously, and found that he was saying it shouldn't happen. So she hadn't read some paragraph in that. I do not anticipate that changing in my lifetime. After, I don't know. But the strong, long tradition of the church has not been to ordain women priests. Through research I've done, I have come upon material that indicates that because of the diversity of theological and spiritual documentation and experiences in some dioceses, women were ordained deacons. Sometimes the bishop would mandate a woman to a diaconal ministry. Sometimes he would initiate a woman into a kind of a diaconal, more formal ministry. But in some instances, and we have documents to show this, that whatever was done for a man deacon was done for a woman deacon. There were exceptions, as I say, from diocese to diocese, but I would support that view. Now, at that time, it was not possible for a deacon to go on to be admitted to priesthood as it is today. And that is one of the obstacles that seems to have prevented the admission of women to the ordained diaconate in the early church, in the current church, where there was a difference in the beginning. So that's sort of one question. The other
question. Well, what does a deacon do?
Oh, very good. The form of baptism in the early church really brought about the need for a woman deacon, because when you read documents from the baptismal rite, at one point in the ceremony, the person being baptized was brought into a pool. There are usually three steps going down into water, and the person went in naked. So in the Roman Empire, it would have been unthinkable for even a pagan man to have done anything to assist a naked woman, even in a religious ceremony. So there had to be a woman who would assist the bishop in making sure the woman was not being looked at by curious eyes, that when she had been immersed three times in the holy water, that she'd be immediately surrounded by a big white, I think, woolly or big good Turkish bath towel, and taken off to a side room where she'd be dressed. A woman only could do that. Also, a woman would go to visit women who were sick in their homes and who wanted to receive the Holy Eucharist in communion. A woman would do that. So there were certain sacramental diaconal services that were admitted and allowed for women deacons, and that was why it was necessary to have them, while men would be doing that kind of thing for the man.
Wow.
So,
Caller, we're getting a lot of static, I think, from your line. Is it all right if we cut you off? Do you have another question? I know we haven't gotten to the birth control issue,
no.
But is that all right?
Well, I do have one more question, which is I have a friend who's a nun in the Detroit area and is a chaplain at a children's hospital. And she does everything but give communion. She gives funerals and all sorts of stuff. So,
yes, and that is admitted. Where it is not a question of administering a sacrament that would be reserved to an ordained priest, there are many, many pastoral, devotional, spiritual things that a woman can do today. And that is one of the things I like to say to women. Don't run ahead of the church. Don't drag behind the church. Know the law of the church, and wherever you see an open door, walk through it. And there are many open doors to women in the church, more than when there were even 10 or 15 years ago. So that's a good thing to do.
Thank you. And do you want to respond to her question about birth control?
Oh, that's such a difficult question. The position of the Catholic Church, certainly abortion is out of the question from the beginning. I mean, early in the first and second centuries, there are documents that say the child in the womb must never be destroyed. Birth control is different, and I always feel that is a realm where the person has to know the rule of the church and to have a good spiritual pastoral confessor who can help that individual in an instance where I cannot say what could be done. I know that's not a satisfactory answer, but in that realm of moral theology, you have to know the teaching of the church, and it's necessary to know because there are exceptions that can be made in some instances.
Sister Agnes, when you were answering the question, you began with talking about abortion, and you used as the basis for your answer what the earliest church did, the records of the earliest church. And yet you yourself are a bit of an exception, aren't you, in terms of being a teaching theologian in the church, well, the first one perhaps in
yes,
the
and
Catholic
I always,
world?
Yes, I
so
know.
So how do new things come about in the Catholic Church, or must one always be ruled by tradition?
Well, there is such a thing as what I used to call in my classes at the seminary, tradition with a capital T, and those traditions that begin with a lowercase t and end with an S. And the strong apostolic capital T tradition often is not as restrictive as some of those traditions that developed later. My friend Irenaeus, my good friend Irenaeus, when he went on that message to Rome, on that commission to Rome, one of the things that he was to consult the Pope about, a question that had been asked earlier.
Third century.
He died probably 202, so
okay.
Early, yes.
Yeah.
And the question was, when do we celebrate Easter? The famous Quattrodecimum controversy. In some local churches, Easter was celebrated on April 14th. It was Nisan in the Jewish calendar, because that was the date on which it had first occurred, the resurrection had first occurred. Well, Christ's resurrection had occurred, all right. Other churches celebrated on the first Sunday after the first full moon, after the spring equinox, because that's what the date was in that calendar. And other churches celebrated the resurrection, the Feast of the Resurrection, every Sunday. And there was a great deal of controversy in that period of early Christian antiquity about that question. Irenaeus went to Rome and said that in the church to which he belonged, which was the church that had come from the apostle evangelist John, they celebrated it on, and I've forgotten which one.
I don't know either.
And so what Irenaeus said was, what I have learned from the tradition is that unity in the essentials of faith does not require uniformity of praxis, of practice. That is one of the teachings of Irenaeus that has endeared me to him, because we see it. We see it in the church. We've seen it historically. We see it today. Unity in the essentials of the faith. And he meant the faith that had come from Jesus through the apostles to their successors. John had taught Polycarp, who had taught Irenaeus. So he was second generation Christian, that close. And if he could say that, why can we not?
Let's talk a little bit about how you began teaching as one of the first women with a doctorate in theology in the Catholic Church. Where did you find you were able to teach, first of all, after coming out of Lyon?
All right. I came back from Lyon in early June of 1967, and there was another provincial by that time, and she had given me to Father Duncan, who was looking for a qualified theologian to teach in his religious studies theology programs at St. John Chapel. And so...
Here at the University of Illinois.
At the University of Illinois, yes, thank you. The University of Illinois. So in June 67, I appeared, and the next week, Father Duncan called me back after I'd met him and said, well, now that you're a professional theologian, you have to belong to a professional theological society. I said, I'm not a good joiner. I said, I have to know that if anything I join, I can give myself to. He said, you go next week in Chicago. There's the annual meeting of the Catholic Theological Society of America. I want you to join. I said, do you belong? He said, no. He had an STD in theology, in patristics, studying with the great scholar Quaston.
Your same specialty.
Yes, exactly. And he said, no, he said, I have other things to do here at the university. He said, you be our theologian. I went, and to make a long story short, I met the new dean, the priest who had been teaching patristics and early Christianity at the seminary in Mundelein, Illinois, St. Mary of the Lake Seminary, and he had just been named dean, and he was on the prowl looking for someone to take his place. So he and a few of the other professors from the seminary pursued me during
the conference
and offered me a position. And I said, I have a two-year contract down at the University of Illinois. And they said, you can come part-time to begin. Well, to make a long story short, I did. Father Duncan
was both.
Father Duncan was delighted. On Thursday night, I'd get on Ozark when it flew, or on the train.
We remember that, yes.
Or on the train up to 12th Street Station in Chicago. And I taught 2 years. I taught part-time. I'd teach on Friday morning and Saturday morning. That was the schedule at the seminary in those days. I'd come back on Saturday night and get involved with all the things that we were doing on campus through Newman. And there was a wonderful group of students in those days. And they helped me organize religious discussions in the dorms, group meetings of people who wanted to know what Christianity or Catholicism was about. Two happy years here. But before the end of those 2 years, I knew that what the teaching I wanted to do was up there in Mundelein, Illinois.
The seminary.
Yes.
So you were in Champaign-Urbana at the University of Illinois in 67, 68, 69,
69
seven,
six,
those two
I left
years.
In 69, yes.
And then you were in Chicago area, Mundelein's, at the seminary there in the early 70s.
Well, yes, full time, but I had left. I had started there in 67.
Yes, I understand.
Yes.
But what I'm getting at is that time in Chicago and at the
in the seminary.
Yes. With the Democratic Convention in Chicago in 68 and the student riots here at the university in that period.
Yes.
What were you as a Catholic theologian saying to those students and young people in both places when they were wanting to protest?
Well, I was mostly listening, Steve.
Okay.
I was mostly listening, you know. And at times I might have been inspired to say something. I don't remember ever. I remember one time being part of a demonstration at the seminary. They were protesting something, and the rector appealed to the professors, somebody has to march with these students. Agnes, why don't you go? And we carried banners and marched into the heart of Mundelein, had this big rally. I don't even remember now what we were protesting.
Which of the causes it was.
Exactly. Yeah. It was one of the many, one of the many causes.
Right. Civil rights, peace in Vietnam, who knows what?
Could have been. It could have been. Uh-huh. We had a good number of active and activist seminarians in those days.
Yes.
One of my perhaps claims to fame was Michael Flager, Father Michael Flager, still at St. Sabina's in Chicago, a great, great priest, and still an activist, and still getting himself in trouble in the eyes of some people, but always very, very, I would say, gracious and gentle with me. Once told one of the men he adopted, one of the young African-American boys he adopted, that I had taught him everything he knew. But we won't go into that.
So he was one of your students, one of your seminary students.
One of my
now, were they all males?
Oh, yes.
Of course.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Uh-huh. And I was the only woman teaching in the theology department. There were secretaries and librarians and...
We're talking with Sister Agnes Cunningham about her life as a theologian in the Catholic Church. She was one of the first, perhaps the first, woman to get a STD, a doctorate in sacred theology, and to teach in a Catholic seminary. We're learning about her, some of the experiences in her life. And if you've missed part of this program and would like to hear all of it, you may do that in a week or two. It'll be archived at the WILL website. You can find that at 3dub.will.illinois.edu. So will.illinois.edu. Then click on AM, go to Keeping the Faith, and you'll see the whole list of our programs there that have been saved for listening at your convenience via your computer. So we are available to you on your schedule. We have another caller waiting on line number one. Let's go to line one, and you're on the air with Sister Agnes. Go ahead.
Yes, Sister Agnes. I wonder if you could tell us who are your favorite contemporary theologians.
That's a good question. And it's a hard question for me, because as the years have gone on, while I do try to keep up with contemporary theological writing, I can't say that I have favorites at this point, because I am so frequently asked to write articles and give conferences on one of two major areas on which I've put my energies and to which I've devoted my time. One, of course, is the whole world of early Christian antiquity with the fathers and some mothers of the church, and then the French school of spirituality of the 17th century. And so much of my writing is in those areas. There are still wonderful documents being translated, and of course, I'm getting rusty. I haven't taught full-time since 1991. I haven't taught part-time since 2001. And in the last 6 years, I have really been curtailed in pursuing my what would be my professional activities because of other responsibilities in my religious congregation. So I'm interested in any theologian who respects the fathers and is able to take them to see their limitations, as I try to do, and to see how we can move further than they did. And right now in the Roman Catholic Church, we have a great Pope, Benedict XVI, who knows the Scriptures and the Fathers of the Church like the palm of his hand. Over a period of at least a year, every Wednesday when he was in Rome at the Angelus conferences, he gave a patristic catechesis on one of the Fathers of the Church. I understand that book is going to be, that all those collected conferences are going to be published in a book. It will be a treasure, because what he does is exactly what I have always hoped to do with the fathers and what I hope everybody does: read them, recognize what the groundwork was that they laid for us, see where they were limited because of their time and place, and where we can move from there, and what they have to say to us today. I don't know if that answers your question, but it's my answer.
It shows what you've specialized in. One of my teachers always said, well, you should read at least two old books for every new book you read. Would you put it at a much higher percentage than that?
Well, no, I think that's fair. I do try to. I recently read a challenging book called Finding the Voice of the Church. Now, ask me the name of the author. O'Brien. I think it was an O'Brien. And what he tries to do is to say, or to answer, he asks the question, who speaks for the church? And he means the Roman Catholic Church. How do they speak? What do people hear when they hear the voice of the church? And really, do the people who think they're speaking for the church really speak for the church? Very challenging book, very interesting book. So I try to keep up in that direction. I tried to read the women theologians, because they have gone into areas where I haven't had either the opportunity or the time. And I'd like to read theologians not only from the United States. I think we can easily become provincial in our interests.
Certainly. Let's go to another caller, this time on line number two. You're on the air with Sister Agnes.
Hi. I just had a question about, I just wanted to get your opinion on, the path that the
that religion and, you know, the Catholic Church in particular is going to take in the next, you know, 10, 20, 25 years. It seems that, like, we're, you know, constantly getting new technologies and information is coming at everyone at a, you know, a faster and faster pace. And it seems that people have less and less time for the really, you know, structured kind of religion that, you know, which Catholicism is. You know, what do you think the church will do to adapt to these new challenges?
Well, that's a excuse me. That's a very good question, and
thank you for calling.
I think that adaptations are being made. I think sometimes we're not aware of them. I think they have to be made on both sides. I think that we, as persons who are being buffeted and overwhelmed by the whole information explosion, I think we have to learn to husband our time very well. I think we have to learn, and I do try to do this, some professional reading, some spiritual, soul-nourishing reading, some recreational reading. Have you read Three Cups of Tea recently? I have. Marvelous little book. Or the whole series of the books on Botswana. One of the sisters in our house, a convent, introduced me to them, and we wait eagerly for the next volume in the series about that wonderful African country and the way the winds blow across the veldt and the old traditions as they're being met by new. So, but there are many advantages, many adaptations. They're not getting out more quickly enough. One part is translation. One of the difficulties is translation. And sometimes I've just finished reading the last encyclical from Benedict XVI, the Pope, and I don't know if I guess I'll say it on the air. I think it's a poor translation of what must have been written originally in German. And I say that by the punctuation, the syntax, where the verbs come in the sentence.
Yes.
And I've done enough translations that I can recognize a language underneath the what's supposed to be English. So your question, I think, is one that has to be asked and has to be asked again and again. And I think we have to challenge one another. And if we see that in a certain area, the leaders in the church don't seem to be moving quickly enough, then I think we have to listen to the voice of the faithful. You know, years ago, many years ago, a couple of centuries ago, Cardinal Newman was asked by another cardinal, British cardinal, after Cardinal Newman had made a statement about the laity in the church and the role of the laity. Cardinal Manning said, "Why do we have to pay attention to the laity?" Cardinal Newman said, "The church would look mighty funny without them." So, you know, there is a role and a place, and I'm going on and on now in one of these long questions my students used to warn others about. But good luck, and keep asking the question.
Now, there's been some great sadness in the Catholic Church around the world, really, with recent scandals, pedophilia issues, on the local scene, drug issues. How does a theologian help others deal with these kinds of so obvious problems?
Well, I think you know I've been away for the past 2 months. And while I did hear about what had happened on the local scene, I wasn't here to follow all the discussions. But I think if I could focus on that incident, that event, that it would help answer your question, help me to answer your question. As I look at that priest, I had never met him. I don't know him. I know who he is. I've probably seen him at the center. I would say that what he has been allegedly accused of is a betrayal of his ministry, a sin, a crime, and the action of an addictive personality, depending on who you are and what your perception is and your competence. Now, for any or all of the above, there would be a penance or a penalty or a punishment or a treatment. And there are persons who are competent and appointed and responsible for doing that. As a Christian, as a Catholic, as a human being, as a member of our society, with the concerns I have that all of us have for our society today, the first thing, there are three things that come to my mind and that govern my way of looking at things and that I would want others to consider. The words of Jesus, "Judge not and you will not be judged." The admonition of Jesus in the scene from the Gospel of the woman taken in adultery. "Let the one who has not sinned cast the first stone." And then perhaps most strikingly and closest to home in a way, or to any of us, are the words of a wonderful Italian saint, Philip Neri. I forget what century he was from. Certainly the medieval ages. And when he would pass someone on the street or have someone pointed out to him or someone accused in his presence, Philip would say, "There but for the grace of God goes Philip." And I think that, and I found this even in letters by C.S. Lewis, a wonderful little statement in a book I read recently by Ellis Peters on one of the Brother Cadfael mysteries. "I have lived too long ever to be surprised at the possibilities for evil and villainy in the human heart." And I wonder if we can ever really know ourselves until we face that reality in our own lives in some way. Temptation, suggestions, just an insight in a moment of prayer. And that is what I would say and try to help people say. Now, another thing I know I have to do is pray for that priest, for all of those wounded by what he
allegedly.
Yeah. We have to use that word.
Of course.
The staff at Newman, the students, his family, friends. There's woundedness there that needs healing and a restoration of confidence and trust. And I know the Roman Catholic Church has been most scarred in recent times, but look at any profession, Steve. Look at any profession or any other religious family. And everyone's scarred, you know. I mean, it's sin in the world.
Yes.
I believe in the doctrine of original sin, you know.
Now, some people think original sins means babies go to hell if they're not baptized.
No.
But that's not what you mean.
No, it isn't at all. It's that we are flawed, and except for the grace of God, we stay flawed. And even with the grace of God, we have to face the flaws. I don't know if that's answering your question.
Helpful.
But
thank you. Appreciate it. Well, let's move to another difficult question. The current election and Catholics, as long as along with many other people who are guided by their values, their moral standards, have difficult issues to face in the current national American election. How do people, from your perspective as a Catholic theologian, one of the first women theologians in the Catholic Church to have a doctorate and teach the seminary, for listeners who may have come in later, from your perspective, how do you balance issues? If one candidate is very concerned for the poor, but perhaps believes in the woman's right to choose in terms of the abortion issue, another candidate might be go along fine with Catholic doctrine on abortion, but be very enthusiastic for war. How do you balance things and decide who to vote for?
What a question.
Well, we'll save it for last.
Yes. All right. Well, it's a hard question. It's a question I've been dealing with. At one point, not too long ago, I thought democracy isn't the answer. You know, why do we think democracy, our kind, American kind type of democracy, because there are many kinds of democracies, why do we think it's such a great system when my biggest temptation right now is not to vote? That's my biggest temptation, not to vote at all. Why should I vote? Why should I vote? Well, I know why I should vote, because when my father became a citizen and I was 18, or I was a child when he became a citizen, I had derivative citizenship until I was 21, and then I had to decide, did I want to be a citizen of the country in which I was born, Great Britain, or in this United States of America? And my mother said, you're a citizen of the United States. There's no congregation of yours in England. You're never going back. So I think that what has been helpful to me is to talk with other people and to hear the wisdom of other persons who have a better understanding. We don't have schools in the United States to train people to be professional political persons, you know, as they do in some countries in Europe. Our bishops have been wonderful with the statements they have made, calling us to inform our consciences and in the light of that information to vote according to what we think will be best. Luckily, they haven't told us whom to vote for. At least I haven't read any of those things. I don't know today whom I'm going to vote for when I go to the polls, but I'm going to the polls and I shall vote. I will vote. And I think I just have to look at the evidences, the possibilities, and take a chance and trust God. Trust God. One thing I read about a week ago was that everyone who has any human values of religious faith should be making a strong Catholic novena of 9 days of prayer and fasting between now and the election date. I'm going to be doing that.
That's perhaps a very good note to end on. We are out of time. We've been talking with Sister Agnes Cunningham from here in Champaign-Urbana about her life as a Catholic theologian. I want to thank Sister Agnes for being on and for our callers. And thank you for being our guest today. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.